and karaoke. Now back to Weekend Edition.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Americans with lower credit scores are falling behind on their auto loan payments, while some are struggling to pay student loans and utility bills. What does this mean for the U.S. economy? And the wait may soon be over for weight loss meds that come in pill form, and they may be cheaper than what's currently available.
One of the big problems with all of the medicines in this arena has been the cost.
Plus, a complex portrait of revenge and masculinity and the new movie, The Things You Kill. It's Sunday, November 23rd. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. Authorities are investigating a Wednesday night fire at a Staples apartment complex. A news release from the Staples Fire Department says responders were dispatched around 9:30 p.m. for an activated smoke detector and general fire alarm at the high-rise apartments. Firefighters were advised there was smoke on the second floor of the 60-unit complex. They located a person in the second floor apartment where the fire started. They were eventually airlifted to a metro hospital. The fire was contained in a single unit, but several tenants were displaced due to minor smoke damage. They are receiving services from the Red Cross. The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension identified the man shot and killed and the deputies involved in a deadly exchange of gunfire in Onegum on Sunday. The BCA confirmed 37-year-old James Weyes of Onegum was killed. The Minnesota Star Tribune reported he was the former foster son of Leech Lake Tribal Chairman Farron Jackson. The agency's initial investigation found Cass County deputies were called Sunday afternoon on a report of shots fired. While responding, they passed Weyes walking alone on a nearby road. According to the BCA, Deputy Caleb Churn attempted to speak with Weyes, but he ran from him. Churn pursued him on foot. The two exchanged gunfire, and Churn was struck in the right thigh. He was airlifted to a Fargo hospital and has since been released. Deputy David Donner was responding to the foot chase when he saw Weyes emerge onto the road. Donner shot Weyes, who was pronounced dead at the scene. Donner and Churn are on critical incident leave. The BCA will continue its investigation and then present its findings to the Cass County Attorney's Office for further review. A petition is circulating to force a vote by the public on whether a consolidation between the Renshaw and neighboring Carleton school districts moves forward. The Cloquet Pine Journal reports that with the signatures of 5% of eligible voters in the Renshaw School District, the petition could trigger a special election. That would determine whether the schools would consolidate versus leaving it in the hands of the elected school boards. The topic of consolidation in the area is not new, but the Pine Journal reports the school boards finally voted for consolidation in October and plan to have a second vote in January. The boards want to consolidate by next June. Shelly Raskovich and Barb Carnes hadn't been to the Nashwauk High School since they graduated in 1972. Carnes lives in Grand Rapids, but Raskovich drove all the way from Duluth to visit the school one last time Friday with their classmates Wendy Grease and Carolyn Johnson.
Yeah, wow. So we have to do a walkthrough, one final.
Yeah.
Walkthrough and see who we remember, the classes, yeah. The teachers, the kids.
Yes.
The kids who are no longer
and
kids.
Things that have changed since we were here.
Yeah, definitely have changed.
The Nashwauk-Keewatin School District hosted a liquidation sale, selling off chairs, doors, books, whatever was left in the century-old building. People were lined up at the doors before the sale began, and over 200 people had been through with 2 hours to go. The district moved into its new pre-K through 12 building this fall, and the historic Nashwauk High School and Keewatin Elementary are slated for demolition in the coming weeks.
It's, you know, it's sad. It is sad to see it go. You know, I'd like to see it
repurposed
into
something.
Yeah, repurposed for something.
A historic mosaic from the library has already been removed and will be going up in the new school next year. Walking the halls brought up a lot of memories for the girlfriends from 72. Coming up with excuses so they didn't have to swim in gym class, climbing out the windows onto the lawn, a mean math teacher, and school lunch thieves.
And so, to get even, two people put cat food on their sandwiches. So if you're going to steal their lunches, they got cat food.
Alumni and school board members Barb Colmy and Don Warwis shared memories of the school too, like watching games from the gym balcony.
You know, that's how we students got, if you weren't sitting in the bleachers underneath, you hung over the top of the rail.
There wasn't much for bleachers, it was just a little bit. Yeah. You were right in the game.
Another liquidation sale is planned for Keewatin Elementary on December 5th, but Colmy says asbestos abatement has already started there, which may lead to that sale being canceled. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The American economy is a consumer economy. These days, consumer spending accounts for around 70% of the gross domestic product. And what's GDP? It's the economic output of a nation, the added up value of all the final goods and services a country produces at home. So while Wall Street makes its bets on potential profits on chip manufacturing or what the Federal Reserve plans to do about interest rates, we're going to take a look now at the economy's main driver. Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst at Bankrate, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thank you.
There's been a lot of attention lately on subprime borrowers, people with credit scores below 670 falling behind on car payments. And a study by the Century Foundation, a liberal think tank, points to more people getting behind on utility bills. The same for people who have student loans. Are those red flags in your opinion, or just kind of disparate stats in a big economy?
I would describe the situation as pockets of trouble. Overall, the economy is actually still in pretty good shape. We've yet to have the recession that so many have warned about the past few years. In general, GDP is growing. Unemployment's still pretty low on a historical basis. Consumers are still spending, sometimes because they have to, because things cost more, and sometimes because they want to on discretionary items like travel. We are definitely seeing those pockets of trouble, though. It is alarming that subprime auto loan delinquencies are worse now than they were during the financial crisis. Anytime we say that about any sort of financial issue, that gets your attention. Student loan delinquencies are really elevated. About 1 in 4 federal student loan borrowers are either in default or close to it. There are sadly a lot of people struggling, but a big theme here is the so-called K-shaped economy. Basically, the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. There are a lot of people doing well, and there are a lot of people struggling, and there are fewer in the middle. The overall economic numbers are pretty good, but they're propped up by a higher income audience.
Do you have any sense of why you may have more people falling behind on car payments, or why people are struggling with their student loans? Like, what is the pockets of trouble?
A lot of it comes back to the cumulative effects of inflation. It's not so much that prices have run away from us this year. It's when we zoom out and we say, well, if we go back to the start of 2021, on average, everything costs 25% more. And that's been a big strain on a lot of people. Most people's incomes have not kept pace. It's the high interest rates that are meant to bring inflation down, but make it a lot more expensive to pay off your credit card, for instance, where we see near record interest rates, significantly higher rates on auto loans and mortgages than we saw for most of the last 15 years. It's really all of these increases that have stacked up on people.
So beyond subprime auto loans and light bills, are you seeing any other alarming numbers or trends in the economy as it is today?
There's very much an all news is local element to this. And I don't mean specifically geographically. I mean more these various haves and have nots. Do you have credit card debt or not? That's a big distinction. We see a lot of those sort of divides across the economy. Do you have stock investments or not? It's roughly 60-40 in favor of having stocks. Well, stocks have been at record highs in recent months, and those people are feeling a lot better versus those who are not sharing in that. Homeownership is another one. It's a similar percentage. It's about 2/3 of Americans own their homes. Well, they're feeling a lot better than renters because many locked in these really low mortgage rates a few years ago. Their home price may be at or near a record level. It's just a lot easier than someone who's looking to enter the housing market and facing high mortgage rates and high prices. So there's a lot of that haves and have-nots playing out in different sectors.
Well, talk to me about that K-shaped economy. Let's dig in on that. Is this new and unprecedented, or is this like a new normal?
It's been around for a while, but it's getting worse. Moody's says that the top 10% of earners are accounting for 50% of all spending. That's an all-time high in a data set that goes back to the late 80s. It is getting increasingly skewed towards the top, and it does seem that the gap is widening. And it's not just the super rich either. I mean, we even see this trend on things like credit card debt. If you're lugging around the average credit card balance, which is around $6,500 according to TransUnion, if you're making minimum payments at 20% interest, you're in debt for about 19 years and you pay more than $9,000 in interest. That's just a huge difference versus someone who uses credit cards, pays them off right away, gets the rewards. I realize it's easier said than done. Nobody wants to be in credit card debt, and it's often a practical cause like a medical bill or car repair or just day-to-day living outpacing your paycheck. But it's becoming harder for people to dig out from these kind of situations because interest rates are high, because costs are high. The issues are falling disproportionately on those with lower and even middle incomes because there's just not as much that they can cut. There's just not a lot of wiggle room in the budget. And affordability issues are really the number one concern of Americans right now.
That's Bankrate analyst Ted Rossman. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
After the Hamas-led attacks of October 7, 2023, Israel vowed to destroy the Palestinian militant group. 2 years on, Hamas is diminished but still exists. Hamas has said it will give up control of Gaza, but its surviving leaders are trying to figure out what role the group might play. Abu Bekr Bashir is a Palestinian journalist who lived and worked in Gaza, reporting for NPR and other international media outlets. Since 2019, he's been based in the United Kingdom. Abu Bekr Bashir joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You've been in touch with Hamas officials throughout the Gaza war. What remains of Hamas after this war?
Well, Israel killed most of Hamas's political leaders and military commanders. However, some leaders have survived. Members of Hamas Politburo live abroad. One of the main ones is Khalil al-Hayya, who survived the Israeli strikes on Doha last September that killed his son. He has been leading the Hamas team for negotiations from his base in Qatar. He signed on the Trump's ceasefire plan a month ago. They have been working on putting together what is left of Hamas political and military wings to try to breathe life back into the movement.
So how are they moving forward?
Gaza is divided now. Roughly half of it is under Israeli military control. The other half is where a weakened Hamas remains, but they are facing rival clans and militias, some backed by Israel, that are eager to confront them. That is where Hamas is trying to consolidate its control. So right after the ceasefire, Hamas started carrying out executions of rival groups, clans, and militias. But a Hamas security source in Gaza told me that they received direct orders to stop these executions because of the public anger and concern about their image internationally. The Hamas security source I asked acknowledged that some newly recruited security officers lack interrogation training. And I should note that all the Hamas security officials that NPR spoke with asked not to be named because they were not authorized to speak to the media.
Israel and the U.S. have said that Hamas can play no role in Gaza's future governance. Will Hamas abide by that?
Hamas has agreed to be out of the government and play no political role in Gaza. Hamas believes it can go back to playing the role it did before it took power in Gaza almost 20 years ago. That role was more about providing charity, welfare, and education services to Palestinians. That is where they historically gained popularity. But they also carried out many attacks on Israelis, and Israel wants them gone altogether. One major shift is that the U.S., for the first time ever, is actually meeting with Hamas. Walid Kilani, a Hamas spokesperson in Lebanon, told me that Hamas officials have met U.S. officials at least three times in recent months, including Steve Witkoff, who is President Trump's envoy. Even though the U.S. wants Hamas to give up its weapons and its control of Gaza, Hamas interprets these meetings as recognition that the Americans see a role for them in Gaza's future. This means Hamas's ideology will have a safe environment to grow again.
So what is that ideology?
Although the U.S. and Israel designate Hamas as a terrorist group, the militants see themselves as freedom fighters who will never surrender. They believe that a person who dies fighting the Israeli occupation inspires the new generation, while a person who surrenders kills the idea itself. You see this playing out now in Gaza. There are Hamas militants underground in tunnels in an area where Israeli soldiers are in control. The U.S. is trying to negotiate with Israel to let the militants leave alive in exchange for them giving up their weapons. But I was speaking to a Hamas security official in Gaza who said the militants prefer death to surrender.
How do most Palestinians in Gaza feel about Hamas?
After Hamas took over Gaza in 2007, Israel imposed a strict blockade of the territory. People blamed Hamas for the harsh living conditions that followed. But Hamas ruled Gaza with an iron fist and did not tolerate any dissent against them. Since October 7, there has been huge criticism and people blame Hamas for launching the attacks on Israel because it did not protect Palestinian civilians from the Israeli retaliation. However, today, many Palestinians I have spoken to believe that if Hamas survives this war, they will probably remain with them for a long time. So people are more cautious about criticizing them and none wanted to be cited by name. But a Hamas security official recently told me hundreds of new recruits have joined the movement. He said almost everyone in Gaza wants revenge against Israel. In other words, the poverty and devastation caused by the war could push many towards such radical groups in what would be a continuing vicious circle.
That's reporter Abu Bekr Bashir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 6 p.m. Monday, November 24th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The Board's meeting schedule is at kaxe.org. We receive support from the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. Now back to Morning Edition.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Bipartisan lawmakers are pushing back on President Trump's proposal to end the war in Ukraine. They say Secretary of State Marco Rubio told them the plan the president is pressing Kyiv to accept mirrors Russia's demands and was drafted without Ukraine's involvement. The State Department denies that. Nearly 200,000 Ukrainians in the U.S. remain in legal limbo as a humanitarian work and residence program has been stalled since January. The program began under the Biden administration and was paused by the current White House. The Trump administration says it's launching a new phase of operations in Venezuela, targeting what it calls drug trafficking. Venezuela warns the move could spark a military escalation. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Seniors are the fastest growing homeless population across the country, but most homeless shelters aren't designed to accommodate them. It can be hard to climb in and out of bunk beds, keep track of medications, and share communal bathrooms. Now, some new shelters are trying to tackle those issues. Aaron Bolton from Montana Public Radio takes us inside one facility built for medically vulnerable people.
Just outside of Salt Lake City is the MVP Homeless Shelter. It's an old two-story brick hotel that was remodeled to serve people 62 and older or those with severe health problems. 53-year-old Jamie Mangum is in the second category because of lung cancer. Today, she's in the shelter's clinic, chatting with a medical technician. This isn't a service most shelters can offer.
Well, I tripped, kind of fell. Then I really fell, like, about 10 minutes later.
Mangum's wrist is swollen from the fall, and she quickly gets it ramped up.
Especially with 9 out of 10 pain off.
Mangum says in other shelters she stayed in, she'd likely have to find her own way to an urgent care clinic or get an ambulance ride. Once Mangum is treated, she walks upstairs to her room. The MVP is designed to be physically accessible for seniors with walkers and wheelchairs. Instead of open spaces with dozens or hundreds of beds, two or three residents share a room. Private bathrooms are a big deal for this population.
They're able to take longer also in the bathroom and not be afraid of people getting upset.
Bailey Delos manages the MVP shelter for The Road Home, a local nonprofit. Traditional shelters sometimes ask seniors to leave because they're unable to care for themselves. MVP was designed to be different.
We have clients that need memory care also, that maybe they were living independently before, but they were unable to maintain that and got evicted due to dementia or different things like that.
The staff includes on-site medical case managers. Primary care doctors and therapists visit weekly. In addition to the clinic, there are even private spaces for physical therapy. Matt Haroldson manages medical services at the shelter. He says the first thing most residents need help with is medication.
A lot of what our patients face on the streets is that their medications get jacked when they're in their camps.
Insulin is a special problem living on the street.
Yeah, to keep it cold, they bury it underground.
Helping the residents manage their medications helps them stabilize their health.
Especially when it comes to mental health, it's like a game changer.
Nonprofits and local governments are trying to build shelters for seniors in places like Florida, California, and Arizona. The National Healthcare for the Homeless Council says addressing seniors' medical problems is key to helping them get and keep permanent housing. Jacob Turner is with the Task Force for Ending Homelessness in Florida. The nonprofit runs a shelter in Fort Lauderdale called Elder Haven.
Over 80% of the people who have stayed in our program this past year have moved into stable or permanent housing.
The MVP shelter in Salt Lake City is also having good success. So far this year, staff have found permanent housing for 36 seniors.
Hey, Rodney, how you doing? Huh? You good?
Outside the MVP shelter, 62-year-old Jeff Gregg is playing fetch with his dog, Ruffy. An old back injury keeps him hunched over, even while he throws the ball. It also fueled a decades-long addiction to opioids.
Fighting that, having a job, the insurance, and then losing the job, not having the insurance, and then I go out to the street, and then I just be right back in the same position.
Greg says sobriety took a backseat to more immediate needs, like finding food and a bed in a shelter. He says the MVP was the first place where he could relax and focus on recovery.
I was able to get clean. It took me a couple months, but I just kept plucking away.
He says that paved the way for him to finally schedule back surgery. He hopes with less back pain, he can get a job to help him afford an apartment. For NPR News, I'm Aaron Bolton in Sandy, Utah.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with Montana Public Radio and KFF Health News. Drugs like Wegovy and Ozempic have become increasingly popular options for millions of people who want to reach a healthier weight. But the drugs, taken as weekly injections, aren't for everybody or every wallet. That's why experimental pills that could do the same thing are drawing so much attention. A Wegovy-style pill is expected to win approval from the Food and Drug Administration by the end of the year. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here to talk with us about that possibility. Good to have you here, Sydney.
Thanks for having me.
Why hasn't there been a pill version of these drugs until now? I mean, it seems like something a lot of people would want.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And there sort of is. It's called Rybelsus, but it's only approved for type 2 diabetes. It's made by Novo Nordisk, which is the same company that makes Ozempic for type 2 diabetes and Wegovy for obesity. But it's a lower dose of the active ingredient these injectable drugs share, semaglutide. The new pill would be a higher dose aimed at patients with obesity. And studies show its efficacy is pretty close to Wegovy's. Tracy Zvinich is the director of policy strategy and alliances at the nonprofit Obesity Action Coalition. She says more options would be a big deal.
The patient community in the obesity space has been living without, gone without treatment for so long. So new innovations, new treatments to treat this chronic disease, all are welcome, all are exciting.
She says a lot of patients are hopeful about the new pills, particularly if they've had a hard time accessing the injections for one reason or another.
Okay, so how would this new pill work? Is it the same as the injectable versions?
So semaglutide, that active ingredient, gets broken down pretty quickly in the stomach, too quickly to actually get absorbed and do its job. That's why it's mostly been an injectable. So Novo Nordisk added something to it to fix that. It's a chemical with a long name, but the abbreviation is SNAC, SNAC. Andrea Traina, one of Novo Nordisk's obesity directors, explained how it works.
If you think about dropping an Alka-Seltzer tablet in a glass of water, that immediate fizzy reaction that occurs, that is what happens in your stomach as soon as this tablet hits the base of your stomach, hits that stomach wall.
It creates this fizzy environment just around the pill, blocking the stomach acids from breaking it down too quickly and giving it enough time to get absorbed into the bloodstream. It takes about 30 minutes. So the pill needs to be taken on an empty stomach and you can't eat or take other medications until it's absorbed.
Okay, it seems like that might turn at least some people off. What have you heard from patients?
Yeah, well, there are other popular drugs that people already take that need to be taken the same way. So it's not a deal breaker for everyone, but not everyone is interested. If the injections are already working well for them, this would be a daily pill. The injections are weekly. But the big hope from patients is that this pill will be cheaper and get better insurance coverage than the injections. One person told me they just hope it's less expensive than their mortgage. Dr. Richard Siegel is an endocrinologist at Tufts Medical Center.
One of the big problems with all of the medicines in this arena has been the cost, and can we equitably get these medicines to the thousands, you know, millions really of people who might benefit from them.
He says 3/4 of the messages he gets from patients are about these drugs, and a lot of them are dealing with renewals and insurance companies. His office is staffed to handle that, but not every doctor's office is. When some people lose insurance coverage, they can afford a few $100 a month to buy directly from the drug manufacturers. But a lot of people can't, even with recent company discounts that make it as low as $200 a month in some cases.
So do you think the pills actually will be cheaper?
so I don't know for sure, but pills typically are cheaper to make than drugs given by injection. The injector pens can also add to the cost. As for Novo Nordisk, it hasn't announced its sticker price yet. However, as part of a deal with the Trump administration, it said that for patients not using their insurance, they'd offer it for $149 a month. That's a cheaper direct-to-consumer price than for injectables, so it could be an encouraging sign. The company says access is an issue that it's working on with other parts of the drug supply chain.
That was NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin. Thank you so much, Sydney.
You bet.
There's a lot of concern right now about what American students are or aren't learning about civics, and that includes the workings of the court system. For many young people, it can all be a bit of a mystery. But one New York City program, now in its 41st year, aims to address that. NPR's Sequoia Carrillo went along to watch high school students step into the courtroom and argue their case.
Oye, oye, oye. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are now admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting.
It's 9:01 a.m. in a classroom at Fordham University's Law School, and court is now in session. Students from six New York City public schools have convened for the first day of a month-long competition. There are two prosecutors, two defense lawyers, and three justices, Fordham Law students, sitting in judgment. One of them is Matthew DeBoer, who kicks things off.
God save the United States and this honorable court. The court will now hear Carmen Bundy versus Lista City High School.
Your Honor, may I start?
Yes. First up with an opening statement is Magda Kadir, a senior at Susan E. Wagner High School in Staten Island. She got up at 6 a.m. to make it to Midtown Manhattan on time.
May it please the court, I represent the petitioner Carmen Bundy on the Fourth Amendment issue.
The fictional case here is simple. A high school student is implicated in a pranking incident, and as a result, she's brought to the assistant principal's office for questioning. While inside the room, the school resource officer searches her phone and does not read her Miranda rights. Kadir is part of the prosecution team, arguing that search was unlawful.
We contend that the search of Carmen Bundy's phone that responded at least to City School District was a clear violation of her Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures.
Brianna Mojica, a senior from New York City's High School for Law, Advocacy, and Community Justice, is defending the school district. She tells the court it wasn't really an interrogation.
Just because a school resource officer who is a certified law enforcement officer is present doesn't mean the questioning is custodial. Similar to how the presence of a priest doesn't turn a gathering into a church service.
It's a 30-minute back and forth that ultimately ends with the justices leaving the room to score the students. Civics education is a subject long held as a bipartisan one, only recently making waves as President Trump criticized current methods for teaching it and has vowed to change the system. According to the nation's report card, civics scores for eighth graders in the U.S. have been on the decline since 2014.
We want all our students to have a baseline understanding of government, right?
That's Michael Seif, the senior program manager at the Justice Resource Center, a nonprofit that oversees this competition and civics programs around the city.
We want students to understand the importance of oral advocacy, to be able to look at law-related and civic-related issues analytically and critically, and be able to apply them in their lives.
Wonderful job, everybody.
At the competition, after getting their feedback from Emily Knight and the other law student justices, it's easy to see the confidence boost in the students.
This is so impressive that y'all are doing this, and I really want to commend all of you on the hard work that you've, like, very clearly put in and what I'm sure...
Brianna Mojica talked to me afterwards and couldn't stop smiling.
You feel proud of yourself?
Yeah. I'd like to thank the Academy and Criminal Minds and Suits.
Going into law isn't exactly a new goal for this 17-year-old.
When I was like seven, I watched Legally Blonde, and then I just whipped out a notebook and was like trying to figure out the case with her.
Her opponent in this case, Magda Kadir, is newer to the idea of law. She joined moot court mostly because her teacher asked her, but now she's hooked.
Not everyone gets justice. People walk away knowing something happened to them and it wasn't even their fault, and I feel like I want to be there helping them, defending them, and making sure no one ever is in the wrong.
One of Kadir's teachers, Marla Kleinman, says giving students a feel for their own voice is a big part of their school's civics-heavy curriculum.
Our students, they understand how to have a respectful, civil conversation.
She says that's what their curriculum is all about, producing respectful and engaged citizens.
It's okay to challenge ideas, not people.
Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Grown children of a certain age know this is the sound of space invaders. For Rebecca Heineman, this was the sound of a new life. She was a teenager in the late 70s, just as the first video game boom was underway. Like a lot of kids back then, she couldn't afford to buy Atari game cartridges. But unlike a lot of kids back then, she had the skills to reverse engineer and pirate her own. By 1980, Heineman had mastered the Atari 2600 version of Space Invaders. And as she recalled in the Netflix documentary High Score, she found her way to the first ever U.S. Space Invaders Championship in New York City. She was far from home and just a kid, up against some of the best gamers in the country.
I was 16, and I've never left home. And now I'm going to New York City by myself to play a Space Invaders video game contest.
She was scared, but everyone else should have been scared of her. After a grueling 2-hour final, Heineman finally was declared winner, the first formally recognized video game champion in U.S. history. A big victory, but also way too much time staring at pixelated 8-bit aliens on the screen.
With that, I just reached over, grabbed the cartridge, yanked it out, and just put it down. And I'm like, I don't want to play this game ever again in my life.
Heineman was born in Whittier, California. She died last week at the age of 62, and she's remembered as a trailblazer, not just with a controller in her hand. In 1983, she co-founded Interplay Entertainment.
All of us at that point were extremely young. I was actually the oldest one. I was the only one that could buy alcohol.
That's co-founder Troy Worrell. The company they built together put out classic titles like Fallout and Bard's Tale. Worrell says Heineman could take your good idea and make it better. And she was always generous with her knowledge.
She was very open and willing to teach people and help them progress in their abilities and their knowledge.
In the early 2000s, she became a pioneer again, coming out as transgender. Later, Heineman served on the board of the LGBTQ advocacy group GLAAD. Sarah Kate Ellis is the group's president and CEO.
She really used gaming as a platform because so many marginalized people find refuge in gaming, and she put those two things together and fought for all the voices, women, trans folks across the board.
After Interplay, Heineman founded other gaming companies and kept up her advocacy. She had her own YouTube channel where she would tell stories about the industry and her life. In her last post, just a couple of months ago, she announced she was diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer. Even then, she remained upbeat.
Whether I have 20 weeks left to go or 20 years left to go, that's something that it's out of my hands. I'm going to do my best to fight this, to stay alive and stay annoying everyone around you for as long as I can.
Rebecca Heineman was many things, but to friends and people she touched, she was far from annoying. As one game developer wrote on social media, her achievements were great, and so too was her kindness. This is NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition this Sunday morning here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji, with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. The Brainerd Noon Sartoma Club presents Winter Wonderland, a drive-through light display at Northland Arboretum in Brainerd beginning Thanksgiving night. It runs Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays from 5:30 to 8, plus the full week between Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve. Advance tickets available at BrainerdNoonSartoma.org. You can become a Minnesota Master Naturalist during a 5-day training at Long Lake Conservation Center in Palisade, January 17th through the 21st. Find more information and register at MinnesotaMasterNaturalist.org/courses.
I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. Lawmakers from both parties are pushing back on President Trump's proposed peace plan for Ukraine. They say Secretary of State Marco Rubio told them the proposal Trump is pushing Kyiv to accept is a Russian wish list and not the actual proposal that Washington is offering. The State Department denies that claim. Israel has launched new airstrikes across Gaza that have killed at least 24 people. According to Palestinian health officials, more than 80 others were injured. A shelter-in-place order has been lifted for neighborhoods near the Port of Los Angeles. It was issued after a fire broke out on a container ship that was carrying hazardous materials. Officials say the blaze is nearly contained. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege but a right. Learn more at RWJF.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. At first glance, it was just another old box in the attic. Three brothers were cleaning out their mother's old house when they cracked it open and made a multi-million dollar discovery. Hidden under a stack of newspapers, not a bird or a plane, but Superman. Or at least one of the first comic books to feature the Man of Steel. The 1939 original edition of Superman number 1 fetched an eye-popping sum at an auction last week. The bidding climbed higher and higher, egged on by an enthusiastic auctioneer.
If you do not get this, you will kick yourself in the morning, regretting every second that you didn't spend the money to get this. I can guarantee it. Let's go to $7.7 million.
It ended up selling for over $9 million with all the fees included, making it the most expensive comic ever sold. Heritage Auctions, the company that arranged the sale, described it as the pinnacle of comic collecting. And the brothers, who haven't been named, said their mom was an old-school comic fan who never let go of her collection. So, if you've got some dusty comics you were thinking of throwing out, maybe you're better off keeping them. Now, where did I put my kids' comics? Ali's life on the surface looks perfect. He's a young university professor in Turkey, having returned home recently after spending years studying abroad. He's married to a beautiful veterinarian, Hazar. He even has a piece of property out in the hills, which he's hoping to develop. But his mother's sudden and suspicious death reveals the extent to which Ali's life and possibly his mind are unraveling. The film, The Things You Kill, is written and directed by Ali Reza Khatami, who joins us now from our studios in Culver City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Aisha.
So you are an Iranian, Canadian, and American filmmaker, but this movie is in Turkish. Why did you want to set this story in Turkey?
This movie is very close to my heart. I wrote it based on my own personal traumas and some tragedies, and I wanted to go to Iran and shoot it there. However, for censorship regulations, I could not shoot it, and we had to move the story to another context and geography. Turkey has an amazing pool of actors. I am also indigenous from southwest of Iran that speaks a dialect of Turkish, so I could understand a little bit, and I thought that that's an actually a good way to enter to that culture and language.
The main character of the movie, Ali, he's struggling in a lot of ways. At work, his marriage, and then his mother dies. And it's like something seems to snap within him when that happens, right?
Yes. So this is the story about a man at the heart of it. It's about a man who has a single narrative.
Mm.
And a very simple narrative. He thinks he went to United States. He studied and read a couple of books. He's a feminist because he washed dishes, so he's good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as female narrative arrives, cracks in his simple narrative opens. And through this cracks, Reza appears, and then Reza promised to hold on to that single narrative.
We should note, your name is Ali Reza, and then you have Ali, who's the main character, and then Reza, who is the drifter, who comes into the picture. And so what does Reza represent?
Reza is that desire for a simple narrative, you know, that desire in all of us that makes us want to believe.
It seems like for Ali, that looks like being macho, in charge, just doing whatever it is that you feel like puts you in control.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a masculinity in crisis. And masculinity, by definition, for me, is in crisis because it's a simple story. It's not an expansive story. So you have a simple answer to things. Reza is that simple answer to everything. We have to kill, we will. We have to bribe, we will. We have to do this or that. It's simple.
Well, Ali suspects his dad has something to do with his mother's death, and he does seem to plan revenge. But it's unclear if it's actually his plan. And there is a twist. Tell us about why you introduced that twist, because something happens and you're like, did I miss something? What's going on here? What's, you know what I'm saying?
So, we are nowadays become addict to very cheap drugs of dopamine.
Mm.
And movies try to hold us by all cost, you know, just give us a little dopamine to stay, you know. In that interaction, there is no space for thinking. So halfway through the film, I wanted to pull the rug from beneath the audience and completely disorient them.
Yes.
So audience go like, "What? Wait a second, what happened?
What happened? You know, did I miss that?
Did I miss something?" Now you're out of the film.
Mm.
So you have to willingly find your way to the film. In that decision-making to come back, there is a space created. And there is a space for contemplation and thinking, critical thinking, you know. Films are not for consumption, but for participation.
This film does deal with abuse, generational abuse. And I guess, was that difficult for you to explore? And especially in Ali's father, who, it's very complicated how to view him. Because on the one hand, he seems horrible, but then he also seems to be very loved by some of the women in the family. And it just seems, it's very messy.
But life is messy, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, people are not only good or bad. People are a historical product of their own time. Let's sit down. Let's listen to your stories. And you listen to my stories. And between the two of us, we come with a narrative that lets you live and let me live.
Have your family members seen this movie? Have they had thoughts about it? Or
I ask my family not to see this. This is, I think it's too brutal for them to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of my sisters went to cinema in Australia. She has immigrated there. She watched it. And we had a 10-second conversation about it. She just called me and said, "I'm sorry you had to go through it."
Mm.
And then we never talked about it.
Mm.
Yeah. So I don't expect them to watch this, and I hope they don't. I love them. I love my dad now. I love my mom and my sisters, and I have taken the permission from them to make this film, and I have asked them not to watch this.
Well, you know, who Ali is and what he's made of, that's one of the central themes of this movie. What are you telling the audience about the notions of identity and the self?
What I'm trying to say is that look in the mirror. That image is construction. That image is constructed for you. This is not a story that is God-given. We have made that story. And we can change that story if we are willing to listen and hold the life in its mystery. Life is messy. Life is very messy. And that's the beauty of it.
That's Ali Reza Khatami. His new movie, The Things You Kill, is out in select theaters now. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Aisha, for having me.
It's that time of year for food, family, and reminiscing about picture books.
Oh, we grew up way back in the day, right?
I've lost count, Frank. I'm not sure whether this is the fifth or the sixth book together.
For our series, Picture This, author Carol Boston Weatherford and illustrator Frank Morrison talk about their sixth picture book together, Family Feast.
So I'd like to think we're a winning combination. Of course, it's all because of me, but...
Oh, of course, of course. You, the challenge is I got to keep up with your words. You know, you always keep me on my game when I'm working on your books. You keep me on game.
It started with The Roots of Rap, and I think we were paired because Frank has a unique history in the hip-hop industry.
Way back in the day, back in those things they call the 80s, we used to break dance. I started hip-hop dancing, and then I started club dancing. And while I was club dancing, I was introduced to a lady named Sybil. And Sybil took me on tour. We went around the world. We went to Europe. We were all over the United States. That was a big part of my life. And it kind of changed my scope on art as well, because I had a chance to go to MOVE while I was out there. And now everything my art teacher was telling me came to light. And I was like, oh, wow. When you're looking at the Mona Lisa, you're like, oh, I thought it'd be bigger, but my gosh, it's beautiful.
Oddly enough, we don't actually work together. I do see sketches, and I may provide some input at that point, but usually I don't have to. Usually I'm just blown away and said, oh, this is going to be great. So Frank is very easy to work with. I leave him alone and let him do his thing.
Carol is, when you read her words, it is so down to earth. And with Family Feast, let's just talk about Family Feast. I felt like I was home reading, you know, what happened over the weekend with my family. You have this down to earth soul about you when you write that makes it easy to illustrate.
Well, Family Feast is inspired by the gatherings in my own family. I had written about my dad's family, but I had never really written about my mother's family. And I gave some of her family shout outs. So it kind of shows the conversation, the chaos, and the culinary creations that come out of these family feasts.
We have these feasts at least once a month. Once a month.
It could be Sunday. There's a turkey in the book. So, you know, generally when there's a turkey present, it's at least a holiday. It's Christmas or it's Thanksgiving, and maybe it's Easter. The day begins with Big Ma and Pops, who have gotten up early to do some preparations before the family arrives. And then family members start arriving. They gather in the kitchen, and everybody brings something different to the occasion. You know, whether it's a dish or, you know, somebody's got to be the joke master, the storyteller.
You're going to have that one guy that's laid out on the couch. He was my family member named Harold. Harold would eat, and he would go right to sleep, but he was the chef. So after he cooked everything, he'd eat his plate and he'd be knocked out.
And there's also a dog in the book. It might have been a Dachshund at first. Do you remember what breed it was at first?
It could have been. I was thinking like that. Yeah, I think it was a Dachshund.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so my dog, Gigi, saw it and said, you know, she wanted to know, why isn't the dog a beagle? So I told our editor that Frank would get some bonus points with Gigi if he made the dog a beagle. So Gigi is just like over the moon that she is in a book now.
If you look at the pages, or if you're not able to look at the pages, I'll tell you what, it feels like at one point, there's a Soul Train line coming down with their, instead of dancing, they're bringing their plates in. And so you have one person bringing Black Eyed Peas in, and you got another person bringing the collard greens down the line, and everybody's on one side of the room and the other side of the room cheering them on as they strut down into the dining room to place their food on the counter. And then you almost feel at that point, you need to grab something out of the kitchen, sit down and eat and enjoy this food with them as you read the book.
Maybe I'll read two spreads. Boiling, broiling, drizzling, basting, toasting, roasting, sizzling, tasting, food for thought, for body and soul. Little ones beg to lick the bowl. Tastes like home when family meet, a bond so warm, so strong, so sweet. So what's cooking? A whole, whole lot. Family favorites, piping hot. Black-eyed peas, Bill's collard greens, a crock of Clifford's rice and beans. Pineapples ringing Helen's ham. Red beets next to candied yams. Chicken and dumplings, turkey and stuffing. Virginia's biscuits and cornbread muffins. The scent of love from many hands. Aromas waft towards ceiling fans.
In the process, believe it or not, for a 32-page book, you're going to do anywhere between, I would have to say about 100 drawings or more. I work in oil. Warm, earthy, if it's autumn colors, it kind of looks like the leaves on a tree when you look at when they're those fall colors.
And you've got a yellow kitchen, which that's kind of a popular color right now, trendy color for kitchens.
Mm-hmm. I just want to feel warm when you come into the house after a cold night or you're getting off the train and walking to your building or walking home from church. You open this book up and you feel warm and cozy. And then I sometimes, if it's a page that I can get away with, I would always throw like some spray paint in it somewhere. And I would always throw graffiti somewhere into the book. I don't know if I was able to get it in this book somewhere. I think I did. And if you look really hard, you'll see a number 5 in everything I do. What my son told me, Tyreek said, it's your 5 kids. And I said, okay.
That kind of speaks to the fact that these family gatherings, they're not just about food, but they're about love. The food that's cooked is an expression of love, even if it's just ginger ale and paper cups from the grocery store. And everything that goes on, the conversations, even the chaos, it's all about love.
You know, when you go to these events and you go to these family gatherings and you get to speak to your elders or you get to speak to the children, you tell them what you're doing and now they can see there's a possibility. They can see and touch you. I remember learning, getting so much.
Family history gets passed on, too. Memories are shared. That's how oral history happens, how family history gets passed on. And it's not just about nourishing the body. It's about nourishing the mind and nourishing the soul and just making sure everyone feels a sense of belonging, a part of something larger than themselves, and that's family.
That was author Carol Boston Weatherford and illustrator Frank Morrison talking about their latest children's book, Family Feast. Our series, Picture This, is produced by Samantha Balaban. And for more conversations like this one, you can head to npr.org/picturethis. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. 2025 may be the perfect time for you to give an end-of-the-year gift to KAXE. 2026 will introduce changes in tax rules concerning charitable deductions. Consider working with a financial advisor to see if right now is the right time to increase your support of people-powered KAXE. The Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids presents A Very Good Christmas Carol, a humorous take